This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. This is really our first time back in harness in 2019, but we've been kind of skating about all over the country this week.
Round Scotland again. I've been down in Peebles hearing about their outdoor film festival, and we're giving you the opportunity to volunteer to work on the island of Handa. We've been out there 2 years ago, and trust me, it is a fantastic place. Embrace this, because you won't get another chance, so stay with us.
Beautiful wee island, and because it was the start of the year, I fancied doing something that I always enjoy doing, so I've been flying on an absolutely perfect day. Wonderful it was too. Now, we've covered the story of Scottish beavers since the first trial reintroduction almost a decade ago. Now, that was down in Argyll. That was absolutely officially sanctioned. It was A-OK. It wasn't a problem with that. But there was a second reintroduction which wasn't sanctioned. It was illegal. It wasn't meant to happen, but it did. And then we had to talk about the conflicting interests following the acceptance by the Scottish Government that that second illegal beaver population on the Tay could actually stay. But the one piece of the jigsaw which is missing from all this at the moment is protection for the beavers.
Yeah, at the moment, and it may be hard to believe, it is still legal to shoot the beaver and to destroy the lodges, which is exactly what happened last week. It was all over social media, and regardless of where you stand in it, it wasn't a pretty picture. Now, the Scottish Government have promised protection, but it just hasn't happened so far. And I've been getting the view of Pete Cairns. He's the director of the rewilding organisation Scotland, the Big Picture.
Peter, there were much publicised pictures of a beaver's lodge that had been badly damaged, burnt. Apparently a picture of a dead beaver floating in the river. It shocked a lot of people. Do you think this is an isolated incident?
No, it's not an isolated incident. I think, you know, there is good evidence to show that there is, I won't say systematic, but certainly routine and unregulated culling of beavers going on in the Tay catchment.
And it is legal.
At the present, it's legal, and that's the frustration for people that support the return of beavers, the fact that, it, you know, at the moment, they're in limbo. They're classed as feral animals, so they can be shot or trapped with impunity.
Let's go back a wee bit. They were in Scotland at one time. They should be here.
Yeah, I mean, it's only a matter of 400 years, which in geological time is a snapshot, really, that beavers were here. And, of course, they were reintroduced initially in 2009 in Knapdale, in Argyll, as a part of an official reintroduction. One of the issues, of course, with the Tayside beavers is that they're perceived to be, as it were, illegal because they were released or escaped. And I think, you know, most people's problem with them is that they arrived through unofficial channels, so to speak.
There was a lot of controversy at the time, but the Scottish Government took the decision. Yes, they can stay, and yes, we want beavers in Scotland.
Yeah, exactly 12 months ago, they committed to bringing in legislation under the EU Habitats Directive to protect them in the wild in the first half of 2018. Here we are, you know, at the start of the first half of 2019, and we're still in the same position.
The government making any noises? I mean, I've asked the minister, and she said it's going to happen soon. Any reason why it's not happening?
I can't imagine any legitimate reason for it not happening. Obviously, there are pressures from land managers, from farmers, but this is in the wake of that land management community already having agreed to at least tolerate beavers. I think what we're perhaps all looking for is some clarity. And I think, you know, in the case of the farmers who want to control some of the impacts of beavers, they want clarity so that they can act within the law.
But you're not against, and many people aren't against, the control of some beaver where they're causing issues, because they will dam and they will flood.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, beavers bring many benefits, you know, which far outweigh the disadvantages of having them here. But they do have impact. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, if I was a farmer in lowland Scotland having my riverbanks eroded or my agricultural land eaten into, I'd have a problem. But, you know, there are other species where there is impact and there is mitigation factored in as part of the management programme. But nevertheless, that notwithstanding, legal protection is in place. So what that means is that lethal control becomes the last resort rather than the go-to solution.
And this wouldn't be by individuals. Presumably you'd want licensed marksmen to do this.
Well, if you take experience from elsewhere in Europe, there's a range of measures that can be put in place to mitigate the impact of beavers. And in most countries, you know, shooting them, trapping them, is viewed very much as a last resort.
Have you heard any noises coming out of the government about what the time frame of this is?
No, and I think that's why, you know, people that support beavers are a little bit bemused, bewildered at the silence. You know, I think it's verging on embarrassing now, the fact that the government have made these commitments and show no sign at the moment, at least, of honouring them.
Do they need protection? The fact that they've expanded so rapidly without being protected might suggest they're going to do okay anyway.
I mean, I think at a species level, they will do okay. They're a very successful species where they're left to do their own thing. But, you know, here in 2019 in modern Scotland, we should not have a situation where a wild animal is singularly not protected by the legislation that protects almost all other wild animals.
What about the next stage of rewilding? Are beavers seen as the start of this whole process?
Yeah, I mean, personally, my vision, if you like, for rewilding, it doesn't focus on reintroducing single species, be that beaver, sea eagles, wolves, whatever. There's a huge amount of habitat restoration work to be done before we even think about that. There's sort of cherries on the cake, as it were. But beavers are an integral part of rewilding. They're wetland engineers, they're ecosystem engineers. They have a great role to play. And I think, you know, society at large has supported that and is accepting that. So we want to see beavers in the wild in Scotland, but with the caveat that where they impact on people's livelihoods, you know, those impacts can be managed.
Rewilding's been bandied about a lot recently. Explain what rewilding actually means and maybe paint a picture of what Scotland would look like if your vision was successful.
I think rewilding means lots of different things to lots of different people, and therein lies the challenge, really, for people like me to bring some clarity and consistency to that definition. I mean, if you read all the, you know, the ology books, the scientific books, it's the large-scale restoration of ecosystems on land and at sea. I mean, in simple terms, what that really means is allowing nature more freedom to function as it needs to, allowing natural processes to govern our landscape more than the man-made system that we have at the moment, or the management system that we have at the moment. And in terms of what it looks like, I, for me anyway, it looks like more native woodland. You know, we're one of the least wooded countries in the whole of Europe. Even with the commitments made by the government, we remain way, way below the 37% average in Europe. So it involves natural woodland expansion. It involves restoration of peatlands, which of course are huge stores of carbon. So, and I think probably what's happened with rewilding is that the conversation has matured. I think it's actually morphing from being an environmental conversation into much more of a mainstream societal discussion because, you know, the health of the natural world is essential to our well-being and survival. We all want to, you know, we all need to breathe clean air and drink fresh water and have healthy food, etc., etc. So actually, you know, you don't have to be a fan of beavers or sea eagles or pine martens or whatever for this to affect us.
Pete Cairns, Director of Scotland, The Big Picture. We got a statement from the Scottish Government and it says...
It said, the return of beavers to Scotland's countryside demonstrates our commitment to protect and enhance biodiversity. We have now completed the technical assessment required and expect to bring forward European protected status legislation this year, along with a management system that protects agriculture and other land uses.
So, we'll keep an eye on that and see how it actually develops.
It'd be interesting to see how Brexit's going to affect that in terms of European protection.
I did wonder about that too when I saw it in the statement. Anyway, after all the excitement and brouhaha of Christmas and Hogmanay, it's quite common for me to actually experience a wee bit of a slump in January. And this year I thought, no, forget that. I'm going to start the new year doing something that I absolutely love, flying. I have lost track of how many times I've been on the M80 heading towards Glasgow, and I've seen planes taking off or landing from Cumbernauld Airport. Now, I've seen it, but I've never actually been to the airport. So on a beautiful day last week, drove down there and met the team from the Phoenix Flying School.
My name is Ian Haggis. I'm a flight instructor with Phoenix Flight Training, also co-owner of the flying club. And we're going to have a flight experience this morning, Mark. We're going to take off and head out towards Stirling. We'll climb up to a couple of thousand feet. I'll show you how the controls work before we take off. And then I'll give you control. And then we'll get you flying. So we tend to introduce our students into hands-on as quickly as possible because we find it gives them confidence and they realise how pretty simple it is to fly an aeroplane. So we've got a great day for it, Mark.
It's a stunning day. I can't believe how lucky we are.
It's brilliant. If only it was like this every day, sure, particularly in January. But it's very calm up there. It's just stunning. And the scenery, I mean, I've flown all over the world. And to be honest, there can't be better places to fly than Scotland when the weather's good, of course. And today we are blessed.
I'm Johnny Allen.
Stuart Hind.
Johnny, for a start, tell me where we are and why this is a good place to fly.
Well, we are at the moment on Cumbernauld Airport. The advantage of flying here, this is an uncontrolled airport, so we don't require a clearance to take off or land, which in some airports like Edinburgh or Glasgow can take up to 15 minutes to obtain. So as soon as we're started up, you'll be airborne within minutes. So we maximise the teaching time in that hour. If it was Glasgow, perhaps 15 minutes in takeoff, 15 minutes getting back in and landing, that's half the lesson gone. Whereas here, we maximise every minute of the teaching time.
How big a problem is weather, Stuart?
I wouldn't say that the weather's a problem. It's more an issue. We tend to find that if the weather's poorer than other days, we can still tend to do certain exercises, like possibly doing circuits. And obviously, if the weather's better, we're then going out and up to the north to do some general handling and things. But yeah, the weather can be a bit of an issue, especially this time of the year. But sometimes we can get some very, very good days when it's nice and cold, as you can see from today.
Ask you a rotten question, Johnny. I mean, if I had money to spend and I wanted my private pilot's licence, why wouldn't I go abroad where I'm guaranteed blue skies every day? Why would I come here?
I think if you're going to fly in the UK, you should really train in the UK. Yeah, I mean, it's true that places like Arizona, Florida are blessed with good weather. And we've had various people, you know, coming from these places, they've never saw a cloud. They don't know what it is to fly in, you know, weather, which is perhaps a little bit more challenging. So I would suggest if you're flying in the UK, train in the UK.
Ian, is this kind of a rich person sport?
Absolutely not. We've got a very wide range of students, from young guys at school. We start training at 14 years. A lot of these young chaps have got their eyes up in the sky. They want to do it as a job and get a commercial license, fly for the airlines. At the other end of the spectrum, we've got more mature students who have always had this desire to fly, but perhaps haven't had the necessary time to do it. So it's a very, very wide mix of folk. I mean, it's not cheap, let's be honest. There are...
Put a price on it, roughly.
Well, for most people, I would say, who have reasonable aptitude, you're probably looking at somewhere in the region of about £8,000 to £10,000 to get a private pilot's licence, which I know it sounds a lot, but if you compare it to other pastimes like golf or sailing, then I think it's pretty reasonable. When I started to fly way back in the days of Wilbur Wright, I guess, flying was, I think, if I remember rightly, I think it was about £7.50 an hour.
Wow.
But you've got to bear in mind that the national wage then was about £20 a week. So in relative terms, it's probably no more expensive. And it's so addictive. You've just got to do it.
Yeah. Ian Haggis there from Phoenix Flying School. We also have Johnny Allen and Stuart Hind. And we'll get more from Ian later in this podcast when I get an absolutely pitch-perfect view of central Scotland.
You know, you complain sometimes about the hours you have to drive
no,
and the miles you have to
You never
in.
Hear me complain at
you
all.
You are never going to get any
never
sympathy.
A crossword.
Any sympathy if you're doing stories like that in the first couple of weeks of January.
Well, you may recall back in 2017, we took a trip around the North Coast 500 in a wee electric car. It was a little BMW thing.
It's just fun all the way, isn't it?
That's it. It's a hard life. One of the highlights was a visit to the really beautiful island of Handa. The day we went, it was a gorgeous sunny day. Seabirds were in full flow on the cliffs. Here's a wee reminder of our visit. We were in the company of Ranger Tom Ovenden.
So we're just approaching the cliffs here for the first time now, and you can see the fulmars flying around close to us.
This is spectacular. We're about 100 metres above the sea. There are rocks sticking out of the water. The clarity of the water is just incredible. It's quite dark, dark blue. You can see golden sands to our north, essentially the beaches up there, but then dark, dark hills behind that, really dramatic, and these red cliffs. There are a few birds about, but this is as nothing in comparison to peak season.
No, well, I mean, it's not a particularly busy section of the cliff because of the way the ledges are formed just there. As we get a little bit further around and you come to the Great Stack, it'll just be incredible, the amount of guillemots and razorbills and kittiwake that you'll see nesting on the Great Stack.
Tom Ovenden, the ranger, when we visited Handa as part of our North Coast 500 trip back in May 2017. And that was a time when we sat watching the ravens nicking the seabirds' eggs.
Yeah, it's kind of tragic in some way and beautiful in another. And quite often they would come in pairs and one would distract the parent bird and the other one nipped in and got the egg.
Nicked the egg. You know, yeah. And Tom had never seen that before. He'd heard about it. We'd obviously heard about it in advance too. But we saw bird after bird after bird flying past just with eggs in their mouth.
Systematically. But because there's so many thousands of birds there, it's obviously not going to have a huge impact. I'm just listening to some magpies setting up a territory. They're going quiet now. But if you're listening and you hear that chatter, chatter, chatter noise, that's what's going on because they're in full... They're starting to pair up at this season. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to repair their nests.
I tell you something that I'm noticing, and it's because we've had a really, really mild winter so far, is the fact that there's flowers coming out in all sorts of places. But flowers which should not be out at this time of year are beginning to, you know, wildflowers are beginning to bloom.
Yeah, our tulips are amazing.
Yeah. not a wildflower as such. Anyway, let's get back to Handa. We're talking about Handa. Handa is a really beautiful place. One of the sort of real pleasures of going to there is to be greeted by the volunteers who meet the boat. I mean, they'll share the knowledge of the birds. They're on hand to help wherever it's needed. At the time, I think we both said this would be a really good thing to do for a week or two. And we're not the only ones. Volunteer places are in really high demand.
Yeah, but there is still time to apply for this season if you're quick, because as we speak, Danny Thompson of the Scottish Wildlife Trust, she's sifting through a pile of applications from people wanting to head to the island of Handa.
Oh, it's a one-of-a-kind place, I suppose. It's an uninhabited offshore island off the northwest coast of Scotland, home to hundreds of thousands of seabirds, and just the landscapes and just the wilderness is just stunning. It's a very special place.
It's a beautiful wee island, isn't it?
Oh, it's really stunning, yeah. Like, every day you wake up and you just look out the window and it's just stunning scenery. You can't beat it.
But it's a real contrast with, you know, the west side to the east side.
Yeah, the West has kind of got a reputation of being a bit more rugged and wild. And especially your Handa, you definitely get some strong southerly winds. You get a lot of wind, you get a lot of amazing waves, but that's part of what makes it an amazing place to live in.
And you volunteered to be there?
No, I worked there. So I was the ranger for the 2016 and 2017 season with my partner. And we ran the island for the 6-month summer period.
And you got lots of volunteers. It's run by volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't do the work we do without volunteers, really. So over the whole season, we take about 50 weekly volunteers. And then we also have 4 to 5 long-term volunteers. And yeah, without these people giving up their time for free, we wouldn't be able to achieve half as much as we did. So,
what do they actually do when they're out there?
So our weekly volunteers are essential in getting visitors on and off the island. So the island's open to the public 6 days a week during the season. And so volunteers, they greet visitors off the boat, they kind of take them through the dunes, give them a bit of a welcome talk, give them information about the wildlife and a bit of health and safety, and then get them back off the island at the end of their day. Our long-term volunteers carry out a variety of other roles as well as helping with the visitors, and they give the rangers a bit more of a helping hand, so they take part in practical tasks. So we've got a good network of boardwalk and path infrastructure around the island, so they help construct and repair that. They also do a lot of seabird monitoring. So as I said, we've got huge colonies, kittiwake, guillemot, razor, bill, fulmar, and so they help monitor that as well, and yeah, anything else that needs doing really.
So do you have to be fit to volunteer?
Yeah, we do require a good level of health and fitness. Working with the visitors as a weekly volunteer requires moving a heavy jetty to get volunteers off the boat, and you're going back and forth through the dunes all day. The island itself, it is rugged, you know. It starts off at kind of like a low beach, but the cliffs are 163 metres high. There are undulating hills, and there's a lot of kind of boggy moorland as well, so you do need to be fit and active, and even just getting your stuff up to the bothy when you first arrive is up quite a steep hill, so... Yeah.
So where do you stay when you're on there? Because it's uninhabited.
So there's basically one building on the island, which we know as the Bothy. And this is, I think it's an old shepherd's hut. So it's got it's about three, split into three rooms. So we've got a communal room with a kitchen, kind of living space for everyone, and a bunk bed in there for the weekly volunteers. And then we have the bunk room, which has a few more bunks for our long-term volunteers. And then there's also facilities, so like toilet, shower and a workshop. And then the ranger has their own kind of separate room at the end.
So do you supply food for them?
We don't supply food, but we can, with our long-term volunteers, we can offer some expenses to contribute to weekly food shops, just because it's, you know, it's a way to say thank you for all of their hard work, and we do appreciate it that it is quite far out of the way, so getting food shopping isn't quite that
easy. Quite a commitment, though, to spend all that time without an income and paying for food.
Yeah, it definitely is, and that's why we try and kind of give our volunteers so much else that we can. Like, we do realise that volunteering for a long period of time isn't easy to do when you're trying to still, I don't know, maybe keep a flat or keep your head above water. But as I said, we offer these expenses. We offer a PPE budget for the long-term volunteers as well, because we don't want them to ruin their clothes while doing our work. But we also try and give volunteers, a great experience and kind of give them skills and new opportunities to hopefully get work afterwards as well.
So do people come back time and time again?
Yeah, a lot of our weekly volunteers are returning volunteers. Some have been coming for, I don't know, up onwards of 20 years perhaps. So yeah, people really love it, and I think the return of our volunteers shows.
What's the demand like?
Our weekly volunteer posts are in high demand, so I'm currently sifting through applications for this coming season already, and especially in the midsummer, We get fully booked so quick, and the fact that people come back again means it's very, very highly in demand.
So is it too late for people to volunteer for this year?
Not at all. So our applications are open right now. Our long-term positions, we've got a assistant ranger post, a skua field worker and a seabird field worker, and they're all open for applications until the 11th of February. And again, with our weekly post, they're open for the same time as well, but they're filling fast, so you have to get in quick.
What makes you choose some person in particular? What's the attribute you're looking for?
So, like we said already, we want a really good level of health and fitness. That's quite essential. But we also want someone who can be flexible. Scottish weather provides a lot of challenges. So we need people who are flexible in terms of, their time, and also, changing jobs at the last minute, perhaps. But we want people who kind of have a good interest in knowledge of wildlife and really good people skills. You'll be living and working with other volunteers and greeting up to 100 visitors a day off the boat, so you need to be good with people and good at talking to people.
So you need to be a good birder, though.
You don't need to be a good birder. It's amazing how much volunteers can learn in such a short space of time about the birds on the island, and as long as you're kind of keen and willing to do that, then we're happy to have you join us.
So can couples volunteer?
Yeah, we're happy to accept weekly applications from couples and friends and family as well. We've had parent and child pairings. We've had lifelong friends who return year after year. And I said, as long as you know you can live and work with that person for a week, we're happy to have them both.
We might be scaring people off by saying it's an offshore island. It's pretty close to the mainland. It's a 10-minute boat ride.
Yeah, it's offshore, but it's not that far away. So the nearest hamlet is Tarbert, and that's about a 10-15 minute boat ride. And there's car parks there, so you can drive down quite easily. It just takes a bit of a detour up into the north of Sutherland, which takes you to some cracking scenery anyway.
It's a detour worth taking, isn't it?
Oh, definitely, yeah. There's so much to actually see and explore in the area. So if you do come up, I would recommend trying to make the most of it and seeing as much as you can in the area while you're there.
Danny Thompson there, Volunteer Development Assistant with the Scottish Wildlife Trust. And if you are interested in volunteering with the Scottish Wildlife Trust, there is a link to their website on ours.
Yeah, and it's not just Handa. You can go to the island of Egg for a month. Mm-hmm. You can go to Lough Fleet. You can volunteer for a day up in the Speyside Dolphin Watching Centre. Loads of things to do. And if you are going to do it and you do get accepted, get in touch. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Or if you've got any other gobsmacking volunteering opportunities, we're happy to tell the rest of the world.
And it will be perfect weather. The sun will be shining. It'll be warm, friendly,
yes,
approachable. It will not rain. The Scottish Wildlife Trust have guaranteed us on that point. You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. If you believe that, you believe anything. We do like hearing about where you listen to the podcast, where you actually consume this product, as it were, which is what Gavin Wardrop from Salt Lake City did. He said,
"Yeah, I just listened to your podcast on Westry, and I would just like to say thank you, thank you, thank you. As an exiled Scot here in Salt Lake City, I listen to your podcasts on my outdoor walks and enjoy every one, but this one was the cream of the crop. You're both painters of words, and listening to descriptions and sheer enjoyment in both your voices was wonderful. Whenever one of your podcasts is downloaded, I know I'm going to be transported home for a wee while anyway."
Painters in words. Although I have to be said, when we do the live programme out of doors, you know, because you have to get up at stupid o'clock in the morning, sometimes it's more abstract than anything else.
Well, you're working in the dark.
Never mind. The River Arman in Lothian starts life in shots before winding its way into the Firth of Forth at Crammond. Now, it runs through an area that in the 20th century was home to a lot of heavy industry, which inevitably in those days polluted the river. They've left behind lots of industrial remains and mills and factories along the course of the banks. Now, the river is much, much cleaner nowadays, and major work is underway to make it more fish-friendly. I found out more from Luke Park from River Life and Alison Baker, director of the Forth Rivers Trust.
In front of us here is Howden Weir, which was put in the 18th century and then was enlarged in the 19th century to power a mill just further down river from here. And above it you can see Howden Bridge, which was put in at some point after the weir was installed.
It's a really pretty location, this. I mean, we're standing in woodland. There's a viewing platform here. The water maybe comes down 7 or 8 feet, something like that. There's almost a bowl shape, so it's as if it's spilling over the edge of a bowl, this double-arched bridge. It's really bonny, but across there, they're doing really interesting stuff.
Yes, here we have a weir which stops fish from moving up and down the River Arman. So the construction site in front of us is to install a large rock ramp, which will effectively raise the level of the river up so that there will be a lower slope for the fish to run up to the river. The reason why we couldn't take the weir out is because of the bridge above, and to remove it would have caused instability for the infrastructure around us.
I'm just saying, what would happen if you took it out? It wouldn't be good.
It wouldn't be good, no. And Livingston's obviously been built since the weir was installed. Yeah. And so when we're working in an urban environment, we have to protect the communities and people around us.
Luke Park is from River Life. Luke, talk me through this project in detail. How is this physically going to work?
Well, basically it makes a series of riffles and runs that allow fish to get up over this weir that is a significant barrier at the moment. The ramp itself is going to have a low flow channel which will allow fish to get up and over the weir.
When you say a low flow channel, what do you mean? How do you slow down? Because presumably the water's travelling at the same speed as everything else.
By a low flow channel, I mean a channel that is wet when the water's really low.
Ah, right, got it. Okay, fair enough. And presumably when they put this weir in, however many years ago, it must have wiped out several species of fish upstream of this.
I don't know about wiped out, but certainly it reduces the amount of available habitat for a good stretch, because it creates this impoundment or pond, which is great habitat if you're a big fish swimming about, soaking up insects and that kind of thing, but not so good habitat if you want cover for wee fish, and lots of invertebrates don't survive so well in that kind of pond.
Are you a fisherman by any chance?
I grew up fishing the Neth, actually, down Dumfries and Galloway, and do bits and pieces here as well, yeah.
So what species will be able to get up past this weir that couldn't before?
Well, resident trout, as well as migratory trout, salmon, eel and lamprey.
Now, describe a lamprey.
It's a bit like an eel, but with a big sucker on it that allows it to suck onto the side of fish, basically.
It's kind of an alarming looking critter.
It is, yeah.
I remember picking one out of the river in Aberdeenshire and thinking, what is that?
You wouldn't want to meet one
on a dark night. How typical is this kind of project of the type of stuff that your organisation is doing at the moment?
So across the 4th District on the rivers that we have a lot of these weirs which were installed in the past for industrial use. They've been left as a redundant structure now because we obviously don't use them for that kind of industry. So on the Almond here we have 8 that we're looking at as part of this project, but we also have a similar problem on the Leven and the Tyne. And so as part of our work, we're always looking at opportunities where we can undertake these improvements, but also just to celebrate our rivers and get the wildlife and the habitat so that it's there for the communities to enjoy.
Essentially, this whole area is a post-industrial landscape. So effectively, you're trying to unpick this. Rewilding's the wrong word, but just make it friendly to nature again.
Yes, we are. We're trying to address the balance. Humankind has come along and exploited the energy of this river in the past. And now we're looking at ways where we can balance nature with the communities around here and ensure that the wildlife that was here 400 years ago has the opportunity to thrive. So, and interestingly, on this particular project, we're using a variety of techniques on all the different weirs, from technical fish passes to removal to these rock ramp type structures. So, yes, we're having to be very inventive with our partners in how we actually change the landscape here for the better.
It is going to be a really big rock ramp here.
Yeah, it's going to be the biggest in Britain, I believe, at about 60 to 80 metres long.
Yeah. I've yet to meet a fisherman who wasn't also a philosopher. what does it mean to you personally, I mean, just standing at the bank in a river in full health?
Well, without wanting to be too romantic, rivers are a kind of a link between the land and the sea, so I think that's the most kind of exciting thing about a project like this, that links migratory fish to spawning grounds that they hadn't been at for a long time.
Yeah. And it's just that sheer pleasure too of just standing there occasionally just soaking up nature, all the sort of bird life, the stuff that's in the river, on the river, under the surface of the water, everything.
That's right, I think the best times when you're fishing happen when you're having a cup of coffee.
Of course, one of the benefits of improving fish and invertebrates for the river is we get to see wonderful other wildlife such as otters and kingfishers. And all along the Almond here, there's fantastic wildlife for people to see if they take the time and go for a walk.
What we're looking at across there at the moment, Luke, is, you know, those are professionals. Those guys have got big trucks, big vehicles, big diggers, that kind of thing. Is there an opportunity here for local people to get involved?
Yeah, alongside these kind of big works that we're doing smaller habitat improvement works and access works with local volunteer groups. Here in Livingston, we're working with volunteers from Craig's Farm, which is a local community hub. We're doing path work, little bits of bank protection using live willow. As well as that, the River Life Project is always doing volunteer work across the catchment, up on the Upper Avon, on other parts of the Almond, as well as little citizen science projects, school work, scouts work, that kind of thing.
This kind of work can't be cheap, so who's paying for it?
So this work is part of European Union money that's part of the Water Framework Directive work that's undertaken by Scottish Government and Scottish Environment Protection Agency. And we're very thankful to Scottish Government and West Lothian Council for their support in delivering this project. But also, we wouldn't be able to do this without the players of the Heritage Lottery Fund who've also funded the work.
I sometimes surprise myself that I'm not a fisherman because there's something about standing beside that sound of rushing water. I wasn't aware of being even slightly stressed when I came here, and I feel so much better now.
No, it's a powerful and relaxing thing to stand next to running water.
It's a curious mix, what's in front of me here, between the old and the new. You've got what's obviously an old Victorian bridge, twin span, and then this bowl-shaped enclosure that the water's running over. But the workers across the other side of the riverbank have bunded off the bank using big, white nylon bags full of hardcore. There are diggers running up and down. There's a cement truck up at the top there, theodolites, guys in really bright orange jackets and things. They're pumping areas of it out. It's heavy civil engineering, but essentially this is being done primarily for fish.
Alison Baker, director of the Forth Rivers Trust, and Luke Park, project officer for the River Life Almond and Avon project there.
You know what's great is these projects, so many things going on. You have the Water of Leith, in Edinburgh, now with fish in it, all cleaned up, a fantastic place. You've got the River Almond, they're heading down that way to get more fishing. We've got salmon in the Clyde. It's just a really exciting time.
This time of year, though, it's, you know, I mean, I like getting out at this time of year, and we've had some really mild weather recently, as I was saying. Sometimes, though, it can be a bit of a chav. Just think, come on, get out. And I know the weather's not great, but, you know, let's go out and do something. There are a growing number of film festivals of all sorts across Scotland. Film festivals actually fall into that category, as far as I'm concerned. It is a good thing to go and do. It kind of inspires you for the forthcoming season.
Well, it inspires you on one level and slightly depresses you, because they are so inspirational. They are so on the top of their game.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's also very true. One such festival that's drawing increasing numbers year on year is the Peebles Outdoor Film Festival. Ewan went to get a sneak preview.
It's very difficult to describe it. You know, your head is down in the water and you're not really talking. You only talk to yourself for maybe 10, 15 or however.
Just a clip from one of the films. It's going to be in the Peebles Outdoor Film Festival with Rich Rowe. We're sitting in the auditorium, got a lovely velvet seat. What is an outdoor film festival?
Good question. It's something that we've been thinking about a lot at the Eastgate Theatre here in Peebles. We're lucky, we live in a beautiful place and we have a very, very outdoorsy community here. So 5 years ago, we launched this film festival as a means of, exciting and inspiring people to enjoy the great outdoors here, but also all around Scotland and elsewhere. And people have loved it.
To not make people feel inadequate, we're watching a long-distance swimmer at the moment. This is seriously hard stuff.
Yeah, some of it is. I think some of it is real kind of aspirational stuff. Some is inspirational, and by no means would people do a lot of the things that we're seeing on screen. But I think one of the nice things that we try to do is have a real mix of films, stuff that, you know, people are not going to do in a hundred lifetimes, and then other stuff which is totally accessible and totally is something that's reachable for them, or a version of what they're seeing on screen.
Are they good films, though? Or do you have to be into that particular sport to enjoy it?
Well, we'd like to think it does cross those boundaries. I think the films we select, and we kind of curate them from around the world, from film festivals around the world. And most important, it's about the story. So actually, you might not be into mountain biking or climbing or outdoor swimming, but the story is what grabs you, and that's really important.
Because some of them are really quite inspirational, aren't they?
They are. No, they absolutely are. I mean, the film we've just been watching together just now, it's called The Swimmer by an Irish director called Thomas Berg, and it's all about an Irish long-distance swimmer and the psychology of that swimming and what he goes through when he's in the water, in the ocean for 10, 15 hours, and what goes through his head. So it's the mental side as much as the physical side.
There's a lot of film festivals in Scotland, a lot around the world. But you seem to have got a lot of big hitters.
We have gradually, yes, and delighted about that. I mean, this is our fifth festival, and it's grown and grown since those very, very modest early days. And it's grown arms and legs, and we've managed to get some, again, a mix of the big hitters plus lots of local heroes as well, who are also doing amazing things with great stories to tell.
Give me a couple of examples of both.
Well, this year, I would say we've got a guy called Callum McLean, and I guess this is showing how we're ranging from the fun and the frivolous to things a bit more serious. So we've got Callum McLean, who's a mad keen outdoor swimmer. He's done a lot of online stuff through the BBC's The Social and BBC Albert, and he's a bit of a comedy genius as well as an outdoor swimmer. And he'll be coming down and he'll be telling us all about his outdoor swimming exploits around Scotland, and it's, you're talking about inspiration. His thing is wild places, finding wild places, and in his case, swimming in wild places, even if he has to break ice to get into the lock in the first place.
We were watching one from, was it British Columbia, just now?
Yeah, that was one from British Columbia about an ultra runner who, one of the world's best ultra runners, who had a terrible accident running along one of the ridges in BC. And it's kind of his story of how he came back from that. And again, I think with things like that, it was the story. It was him who's been this ultra competitive guy, and that's been his life. And then that all took a back seat, and he had to recover, and he's come back and probably lives a fuller, more rounded life because it's not just about running. He's, you know, it sounds a bit cheesy and cliche, but he's appreciating everything else.
What about mountain biking? Peebles, you could argue, the mountain bike capital of Scotland. Does that feature?
It certainly does. Yes. Yeah.
Fort William's going to disagree.
But. Well, they might, but you know, we'll go toe to toe with them. We do like a bit of mountain biking around here. And one of the things you were asking about, some of the big hitters coming this year, we're really, really chuffed. We've got Hans Rey, who's coming as part of his UK stage tour. He is a former world champion. He's a Hall of Famer. He's an adventurer. He's a bit of a legend in mountain bike circles. He's very much the inspiration for people like Danny McCaskill. And in fact, he'll be talking about a recent trip he did with Danny McCaskill, trying with all sorts of storylines attached to cycle to the top of Mount Kenya and Mount Kilimanjaro, and that was quite an adventure, so we'll be hearing about that from him.
How do these things work? Do you sit down and watch one film a night or an afternoon, or do you sit down for a whole evening of short films?
Well, the evening sessions and in fact the afternoon auditorium sessions are packaged together. We do a programme of short films, and it could be 5, 6, 7 films running for about 50 minutes. We then have a short break, and then we have the headline speaker come on and do their thing. And quite often, you know, they're showing film clips too. But quite often the films we show beforehand are very much teeing up the speaker. So for instance, on Friday night, our headline speaker is a pretty amazing young woman called Cal Major. She does all sorts, but she does epic stand-up paddleboard journeys and adventures, partly because she loves the adventuring, but just as importantly, it's to highlight the scourge of plastic pollution in our oceans. And she's done a huge amount around that. So she'll be here talking about her journey last year from Land's End to John O'Groats, 1,000 miles on a stand-up paddleboard, which sounds like my idea of hell, and all the work she's done with communities on the way, finding out what they're doing about plastic pollution.
Rich Rowe there from the Peebles Film Festival, which starts on the 25th of January. And there is a link to their website on ours at Out of Doors.
Lovely wee theatre in the old church in Peebles, centre of Peebles, if you know it. Lovely wee auditorium. And I'm going to put hand in hand, I was a bit sceptical, but some of the quality of the filming and the stories is just great.
1,000 miles on a paddleboard.
Yeah, I'm kind of
rich on that one.
Yeah, that's this from the pier that managed to do 100 yards on a paddleboard in Dunbar Harbour.
Excuse me, there was nobody in that harbour that was better than me running backwards off the paddleboard.
Yes, that's very, very true.
And the paddleboard was moving much faster than I was.
Wasn't a great image.
Well, the fishermen were enjoying it. There again.
Look, there's seals on paddleboards.
Yeah, you'd think that actually neoprene would hold it all in, wouldn't you? But no.
Well, I think it does. It just
That's an appalling thought. Anyway, let's go back to Cumbernauld and Phoenix Flying School. I just wanted to start the year doing something that I really love. I love flying. I picked an absolutely perfect day. I'd been talking to the dean from the flying school about, you know, how you do it, why you do it, what the advantages are of actually learning to fly in the area that you're going to fly rather than where the sun always shines. So, took me out to the plane. Ian Haggis talked me through the whole thing.
Right, OK, so here we are sat in our Cessna 172 four-seat aircraft. I'll just run through the basic controls because you're going to be flying the aeroplane very soon. On the instrumentation, we have an airspeed indicator. We have an artificial horizon. If we were flying in cloud, which we won't be, plus the fact that there aren't any today, which is
quite nice.
Which is very nice. An altimeter. Now, our altimeter reads pressure. It's in effect a barometer, if you like. So the higher we go, the air becomes less dense. So it through a ingenious system of gears and what have you, shows our height. We've got a climb and descent instrument here, a vertical speed indicator, a compass, and we've got various, we've got a throttle control, a mixture control. But this is what you're going to be using. I'm touching the yoke at the moment. And it works, I think, quite intuitively. If I want to go up, I pull back. If I want to go down, I push forward. If I want to turn to the left, I turn the wheel to the left. and if I want to turn to the right, I turn the wheel to the right. So fairly intuitive. Having said that, what you will find, Mark, when you're flying is that the controls are very sensitive. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't require a lot of movement.
What always impresses me about these things is the fact that, you know, the yoke itself, it's not like a child's toy, but it's nowhere near as robust as a car steering wheel. No. Presumably to engender this idea of delicacy.
Yeah, I think that's probably right, Mark. Some aircraft have a stick, but most of the training aircraft have these yokes.
What was your own background? How did you come to fly?
Wow. I was in a situation when I was, 16, where my father had his own aircraft, so I was in a lucky position, and he suggested to me that he would pay for me to get a license. Yeah. And
this is beyond lucky.
This
is like being dusted for God's fingerprints, basically. <Yeah. laughs>
And what did I say? No, you're all right.
You're joking.
I'm not joking. I was more interested in girls and motorcycles at that time, which was a big mistake. Anyway, years later, I decided that I did want to fly. I had to pay for it myself then, of course, and I got a private pilot's license. Flew around, took friends out, had a great time, and at that time I was in the financial services industry. I decided I didn't really like that, so I wanted to do flying as a job. So I got a commercial license, became an instructor up here in Scotland, and from then on I moved to doing air ambulance, charter work, and then onto corporate flying. So I'm now back to instructing, which I love. So yeah, that's me.
How good is Scotland to fly in?
Scotland is probably one of the best places I've ever flown, and I have flown different places around the world. Scotland is stunning. It's not a crowded airspace. The scenery is just magical, particularly when the weather's good. And the weather isn't as bad as people make out. I mean, we lose very few flying days a year due to the weather. But no, I love it up here. I wouldn't dream of flying anywhere else.
I like that.
Okay, Mark, just lined up on runway 26. About to take off. Completed our checks and power off.
I love that bit. There's that gradual putting on of power, and then next thing you know, that you slip the bonds of earth.
Yes. Certainly gone to that.
Be able to come up here on a day like today, which is effectively more or less wind-free, get this view of Scotland. So we've got the Ben Leddy behind us, Callander. We're crossing the Campsie, though, at the end of the Campsie Hills, the Ochils off to my left. Absolutely fantastic views. Do you ever get tired of it?
Never. No, I always see something new, strangely enough. Uh-huh. And the other thing is that as the seasons change, the whole countryside changes, all the colours, the trees. I never get tired of it. I think it's magical. It really is. I'd rather be here than anywhere else, to be honest. I love it. Okay, Mark, you have control.
Okay. Currently we're flying at about 1,300 feet. Grangemouth off to my right. Heading for the Ochil Hills, three wind turbines straight in front, and you can see the Firth of Forth. What is astonishing about this is the fact that I'm hardly putting any pressure on this at all. The plane's essentially flying itself.
Absolutely.
I know it's not always like this weather-wise,
uh-huh.
And this is possibly just a bit deceptive, but clear blue skies, sun shining through the perspex, just get this tremendous sense of well-being.
Yeah,
bizarre.
Nothing like it. Okay, Mark, if I can take it from you now, sir, you can relax.
Runners are busy claiming quite unnecessarily. Getting your private pilot's license for £10,000 or whatever is one thing. How do you then get access to a plane?
Quite simply, you would be a member of our flying club. You just come in and hire one. It's a very simple process. Lots of people do it. And of course, if you've got several people with you, you can share the cost, which is very popular. I'm just trying to see where I'm going here at the moment, to be honest, Mark, because there was sun right in my face.
But pretty bright.
We're just coming over Denny at the moment. The airfield is somewhere out there to the, you know, 1 o'clock.
This is the bit that would probably worry me most, is actually landing.
Yeah, I think the landing is the part of the training that gives most students the biggest challenge. It's all about judgment. To get the judgment, you need the experience, so we need to do it a few times, but everybody gets it.
Yeah, we're absolutely lined up with the runway.
Lined up, yeah.
Golf Bravo Juliet, no significance of...
So the key with landing is really let the aeroplane do most of the work. To make small adjustments.
I just find it incredibly relaxing.
It is, very relaxing. That's us back. Yep, walked away from another one.
Ian Haggis from Phoenix Flying School there at Cumbernauld. It was just a great day, fantastic.
I love the way to... I'll just take control.
I wasn't doing anything daft.
I really wasn't doing anything daft.
Yeah, no. I was climbing very, 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 very gradually. The thing is, I mean, you just sit... I mean, literally, you're flying one-handed. It takes practically no effort at all because it was flat calm. We're heading towards the Wallace Monument, sun shading in the Ockles. I said, do you mind if I turn left? I said, I quite fancy going towards Ben Leddy. He said, no, it's fine. So, you know, off you go. And we wandered across, you know, the Carse of Stirling. Beautiful.
You've got some great film. Is that going up on the Facebook page?
It's up on the Facebook page already. Oh. Out of Doors Facebook page.
Well done.
You may remember Christmas time there, we were asking you to send in your own soundscapes. We've been doing soundscapes for a long time, but we wanted to hear yours. Andy Craig very kindly sent us one in along with this email. He says, hugely inspired by Ewan's interview with Phil Cunningham about recording soundscapes. I've done a wee bit of this in the past, but to be honest, I'm often defeated by the wind noise, and I really can't justify the expense of proper anti-wind microphone covers.
Just leap in there. You can put a sock on it. If you've got a thin sock, put it over the end of your smartphone, and that will really clean it up.
Actually, this sounds like we're joking, and I'm not. I've actually used a woolly hat, a Tammy, and they're not thin, and stuck it in there, and it works remarkably well.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
We sort of wander off. Anyway, Christmas Day in Northumberland was reasonably calm, so I headed off to find the curlews that normally roost by a river called Long Nanny, halfway up Beadnall Bay. So we're going to leave you with Andy's really delightful curlew soundscape. We'll be back with another Scotland Outdoors podcast next week. From all of the team here in Aberdeen, thanks very much for downloading us, but just enjoy this.